And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Hauck.
Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, helping you find your courage to reclaim who you have always been. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and if you'd like more information about me or to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word there. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And you'll be happy to know that these broadcasts are now podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, you can go back into the archives and pull up any show that you might have missed, or if you can't spend the entire evening with me here tonight, that's fine. Just go into the website and pull up the archive section, and then you can select the show that you would like to listen to. And if you are able to spend the whole hour with me, thank you. I really appreciate that, and invite you to call in and be part of tonight's show, because in the second half of the show, I'll invite you to call the toll-free line at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, because I want you to give me your insights, your comments, and your thoughts on tonight's topic. Bruno and Mirabel talk, listening to the pieces of family drama. And we're going to have some fun just looking at the movie Encanto, and how does this really speak to how do we heal from family trauma? And more importantly, how do we start the process of healing when there's nothing but silence? Okay, so. Well, now in my fifth year with BBS Radio, I am happy to announce that these broadcasts have always focused on the continued integration of spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of our relationships with ourselves and others and God or the divine. And, you know, this is an essential integration of our spirituality and our mental health, because at any given moment, it's our minds that interpret what we take in through our senses. And based on our previous experiences, or our education levels, or our upbringing, and so forth, our mind's interpretation often fails to capture a more accurate understanding of deeper lessons, or realities, and greater truths, because it's our egos, which are very self-centered and limited. You know, our egos come in and they take over and keep us from knowing ourselves as vast and eternal souls, as well as what needs to heal, so that we can live in forgiveness, gratitude, bliss, and love. And admittedly, it is our egos that will lead us astray with all kinds of thoughts and selfish pursuits, or, if you will, a lower level consciousness, which is always bound by time and space and causation. And yet, we also need to pay attention to our egos by asking ourselves in any given situation, as my teacher has told me, what in me has created this perception or this reaction or this distortion, so that we can better understand where our healing and transformation are still needed. So what in me has created this? And here's a quick example. Let's say there's a huge difference between worldly love, which is more familiar to us, and godly or divine love. Now, according again to my teacher and dear friend, we often use the term, I love you. But such love is conditional because it's temporary and it changes as it goes back and forth between conflicting emotions of the mind, such as jealousy or envy or hatred. But yet, godly or divine love is a love that's not entangled in the human emotions of the mind. Divine love is eternal, it's not conditional, and it helps others purify their minds by recognizing only that which is divine in all, in everyone, in all things. And this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about, because I probably the best way I can sum up reclaiming authenticity is through this one word, namaste, which is roughly translated, because I see myself as a soul of light. This allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you are, even if you do not see it in yourself. Well, the integration of spirituality and our mental health begins here, because when we examine and we implicate, or I should say, we implement this integration, we're going to come face to face with the deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and even spiritual woundedness that we may have experienced in and through relationships. It's almost inevitable. In fact, this is also where we will come face to face with our ego and believe that, well, the only way we're going to be able to find happiness and joy and contentment is to discover only that the larger the ego becomes, the greater the sorrows are sown in our lives. Because you see, eventually our ego brings us back to terms with the relationships in our lives. And this could be families and coworkers, friends, and other relationships. But it is godly or divine love that heals and transforms those wounds into something more life-giving, more tangible, and definitely eternal. And this transformation is especially needed with the people whom society says, well, that group over there, they're unlovable. And this group over here, well, they're unreachable. And that group way, way, way over there, well, they're untouchable. But when we do the work of integrating healthier waves of suppressing the ego through embracing ours and their value and dignity and worth as a soul, we transform. And we also transform others by our presence and our grace and understanding with forgiveness, gratitude, and love. Or let's put it another way, as one of my favorite authors, a Dutch priest and professor Henri Nouwen puts it, he says, just by paying attention to what's going on around us, we're going to discover that there are people who heal each other's wounds or forgive each other's offenses, who share their possessions, who foster the spirit of community, who celebrate the gifts that they have received, and people who live in constant anticipation of the full manifestation of God's glory. Well, I'm sure that we've all seen the news reports throughout this day, not about last night's presidential debate, but rather the fact that it's been 23 years since 9/11, which is a day which is still fresh in people's minds and hearts and very much a part of the fabric of a grieving nation and the wars in which we still find our nation involved in today. And for many, many families, today serves as a reminder of perhaps the last time they heard their loved ones' voices, as either they were victims in the Twin Towers in New York City, or Flight 93 that went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and even those who had died in the attack on the Pentagon. And yet, still, there have also been many stories of heroism and other behind-the-scenes kindness from neighbors and friends and even strangers who continue to bring about healing each and every day. Well, in addition to it being 9/11, September also happens to be Suicide Awareness and Prevention Month. And I also wanted to take this opportunity to talk about the emotional and the mental and the spiritual needs families long to have met as they continue to struggle with coming to terms with a loved one who has taken their own life or one who currently has suicidal ideations. And so I wanted to give you two resources that you could use or pass it along to others who are in need. One is the National Suicide Hotline. Okay, the National Suicide Hotline. It's a toll-free number. It's 800-273-8255. Okay, it's the National Suicide Hotline, 800-273-8255. And then there's also the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. It has different resources like support groups that are available. So the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and it's a website. And so it's afsp.org. Okay, afsp.org. There you go. Okay, so it stands for the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention.org. Now, before we get into a little bit deeper the matter of suicide, I just wanted to say something about the stigma that's still out there imposed on others by society. You know, it's kind of ironic because, you know, this is a problem that society kind of brings on itself. You know, because on one hand, you know, they talk about, well, why can't people heal? Or why do people do this? Or why do people turn to drugs? Or why this, you know, and why that? And yet, society is often the one that has the very power to bring about healing because of stigma. A lot of people are kept from finding the healing that they need. And so I just want to say something, just a little something about this stigma that's imposed on others by society. Because you see, although we've come a long, long, long way over the decades and decades in society and the centuries, there's still a tremendous amount of stigma shown to people who struggle with mental health illness. And from what's being depicted on TV or in movies or other shows to stories that are shared among family members, stigmas are still the marks that others bear in silence, which now brings us to the main point of the evening. If you've ever seen the widely popular Disney movie Encanto, then you're familiar with the fictional tale of a magical family blessed with all kinds of amazing gifts and talents that contribute to their community's survival. You know, just a real strong family identity. It takes You know, they take pride in their gifts and their talents, but they use them to serve others. And, you know, throw in some vibrant colors and catchy songs and, of course, dancing, and it's a pretty cool film. Well, what I believe what makes Encanto relevant to any family and the larger community is that despite its outer, let's say, pleasantries and colorful distractions, within many families today, there are personality squabbles and chaos when everybody gets together. Okay, if you don't believe me, just look on your calendar and how many days are we away from Thanksgiving? You know, I have clients who want to, we need to talk about Thanksgiving, you know, and then, okay, here we go. You know, the fact that getting the family together over a meal, you know, it's like we want this to be like a Hallmark card and it's anything but. Okay, so yeah, there are personality squabbles and chaos when you get everybody together. Okay, however, in Encanto, not every member of the family is welcomed around the dinner table, so to speak, let alone allowed to ever talk about the past and one particular outcast. And of course, there's always one member in the family who wants to know the history of why things are the way they are. And of course, trying to find her place in the giftedness in this family. And of course, I'm talking about Bruno and Mirabel. Bruno is the one who is the outcast because of, well, it was something that happened years and years ago. But Mirabel, she is sad because she doesn't have any like recognizable gift yet. Okay. And she's the one that wants to know, why are things the way they are? And why can't we talk about Bruno and all this stuff? Okay. And this is where the story unfolds as Bruno and Mirabel talk about their family's history and the trauma and the silence that shrouds everything. Well, finally, Encanto reveals to us that Mirabel's gift is the strength to reveal the old wounds and these dysfunctional family patterns that are destroying the family. Because interestingly enough, even though she is not quite the youngest, she's still fairly young, she's the only one willing to talk about Bruno. Because Mirabel sees the literal and emotional cracks in the family foundation. And she wants to know why. In fact, she's the only one strong enough to point them out so that her family can begin to heal. And this is interesting because this is a familiar theme that comes up in counseling sessions. As I sit with kids and teenagers who are trying to figure themselves out and work through their emotional reactions to their family's trauma. Because quite often, as kids and I talk about intergenerational trauma, and they're just like, well, what is this? What's this all about? They've never heard this term before. And I just share a little bit about intergenerational trauma and what mental, emotional, and even spiritual woundedness that has been handed down through the generations. And after a while, the kids begin to connect the dots by realizing what they're dealing with. They typically will say things like, well, if all of this pain and trauma didn't start with me, why then did it land on me? Why do I have to deal with this? Why do I have to sit with you? Why do I have to talk about this and that and so on and so forth? And when they start asking those kinds of questions, I usually get a big smile on my face, not to diminish what they're saying, but rather I know they got it. They're figuring it out. And to their questions, I have this simple reply. Well, have you ever stopped to consider that perhaps you're the strongest one in the family to be able to heal whatever the trauma is? And not just to heal yourself, but also heal those who've come before you, parents and grandparents, maybe even great grandparents, but also heal the ones who will come after you, those who have yet to be born, their children, their children's children, and their children's 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 children, and so forth. All right, because you see, families today also face similar circumstances as in Encanto, as younger generations want to unpack stories of pain and confusion and trauma and the worst threat of all, silence. Why is there silence? Why are we not allowed to talk about the Brunos in the family? Why are certain subjects off limits? And so on and so forth. And yet, sharing perspectives and experiences allow the family's silence and secrets to be healed for all generations. Because, for all intents and purposes, and getting back to suicide, still carries with it a stigmatized silence that plagues generation after generation after generations. And so let's look more closely at the stigma that's imposed on others by society. Because although we've come a long way over the decades, there's still just a tremendous amount of stigma shown to people and their families. Okay? And as a result, many people feel stigmatized by their illness, or they're shunned, or they're alienated from, let's say, fully participating in their communities as people of value and worth. And this expulsion of, you're not welcome here, so go away, out of sight, out of mind. This expulsion was true for not only people who had, let's say, an identifiable, unacceptable physical condition, but also for those who had a condition that was not readily seen, such as mental illness. But going back down through world history, it was actually the Greeks who originated the term stigma, which refers to a bodily sign designed to expose something unusual and negative about the moral status of the one who bears this stigma. And these signs, again, imposed by society, were cut or burned into a person's body, which advertised his or her condition. That is, they were a slave, or they were a criminal, or a traitor. And as a result, this act of branding another person signified to all that the recipient was a blemished person, or they were ritually polluted, and therefore they needed to be avoided, especially in public places. Okay, you remember the Scarlet Letter, right? Okay, Hester Prynne. That still, it pointed to a larger problem in society. And such markings not only, spoil a person's social identity, but also it cut them off from that, cut that person off from society and forced them to live in isolation in a very unaccepting, unforgiving world. And from this aspect, it appeared as though there was no way to remove this outward sign, let alone recover from the emotional wounding from such harsh treatment. And while not always spoken about, society clearly distinguishes between the so-called people who are clean versus people who are unclean, people who are acceptable versus people who are unacceptable, people who are lovable versus people who are unlovable, and so on and so forth. And this all ties into something that's also very common in today's world, and that's disenfranchised grief. Because within disenfranchised grief, people living with, let's say, even a suicide ideation, as well as family members struggling to make sense of a loved one who has taken their own life. Society's stigma is more than likely going to be transferred to their surviving loved ones. It's almost automatic. It's almost like a guilt by association. Because despite its unpopularity, it's crucial to give voice to the disenfranchised and to embrace them as people of value and worth. And I say, despite its unpopularity, because even though this is very much needed, it's still unpopular because, well, you got to get your hands dirty. You just will be associating with people that society says are unacceptable or unlovable or unclean. And the survivors of those whose loved ones have committed suicide, not only are left with a tremendous sense of shock and disbelief, but also with intensified feelings of, say, loss, maybe even blame, or fear, or shame, or rejection, or anger, or guilt, and many other unanswered questions. And while anger is a normal response to any type of loss, suicide survivors, family members, and so forth, may have intensified anger, often directed at the deceased or the mental health system or themselves for not being able to recognize the signs or for not being able to rescue the deceased. Because despite advances in understanding the complexity of suicide, and like I said, we've come a long, long way, social stigma remains an ongoing burden for the surviving family members. In fact, my own research on healing from stigmatized losses, just stigmatized losses in general, there's always two parties involved in the pain and suffering that suicide inflicts. One, the surviving family member always suffers more from stigmatized illnesses or stigmatized conditions. And again, they always suffer more stigma from society. Okay, always two parties involved, those who suffer and those who survive. And one of the researchers that I came across, actually, it's a team, Berman and Jobes, they noted that suicide often becomes a family secret, or it could become a neighbor's gossip, or a source of public blame and shaming or shunning. And even to this day, surviving family members may attempt to conceal the suicide or hastily arrange funerals or suit the, from keeping the truth from children. Again, there's stigma and there's silence. And so the survivors, were doomed to their own private shame, maybe even trapped by their feelings of hurt and loss and anger. And the mourning rituals, the ceremonies that we do for surviving family members are often compromised by this lack of social support, even within their own faith communities, I've found. Because some clergy may refuse to participate in the common burial practices with a religious affiliation or a particular denomination. In fact, history has shown that some may even deny, burials in a church-owned cemetery. Like I said, we've come a long way in this area, but still, stigma is out there. And another factor that is often overlooked that just exacerbates the pain of surviving loved ones is that, further still, witnessing suicide or finding the body of a loved one or continuing, the imagery of the death or pictures of the remains through like police reports and other things is also going to likely result in PTSD. And one aspect of suicide that profoundly exacerbates the grief reaction of surviving family members is that many suicides may occur in the home. And the physical remains of a person who has committed suicide still may be present in the home, even after the police show up and a coroner will come or a funeral director will come, and they require the family to clean up the blood or the bone fragments, in addition to planning the funeral service. And one study I found that 11% of people who having a report a loved one committing a suicide in the home had PTSD symptoms after discovering their loved one's body. And the survivors also reported feeling totally exhausted and unable to resume their daily routines because it has taken that much out of them emotionally and mentally and physically, even spiritually. Okay. Well, initially, and this is unfortunate, society still places some of the blame for the suicide on a family member, and they therefore may offer less social support than they would for survivors of, let's say, a natural death. They may feel alienated from their friends and acquaintances because of the blame or the rejection and lack of understanding on the part of society. Getting better, we still have a long way to go. And families today also face similar circumstances as, let's say, the younger generations want to unpack stories of pain and confusion and trauma, as well as, say it with me, silence. However, sharing perspectives and stories and experiences allows the family secrets and the family silence to be healed for all generations. So, how do we transform generational wounds? Well, first of all, let's keep in mind that no one person or an entity in history ever acted alone. And no secret remains hidden and no truth ever stays buried. And yes, to be blatant here, dead men and women and children do tell tales of how they died. And some died of natural causes, some died at the hands of others, and even some people were not even considered worthy to be buried respectively. But for all of these atrocities and more, it's time for us to begin telling the stories of how people live. It's time for us to see them for who they are, souls. Souls that live on after their hearts have stopped beating and their brain waves have ceased. Souls that surround us like a great cloud of witnesses or a communion of the saints, if you will. because those who have come before us, our ancestors, they're the ones always speaking to us constantly through the blood that runs through our veins. And yet, how do we reconcile these events with what we do today? And this is the real effort behind healing intergenerational trauma, because trauma has the potential to disconnect us from realizing ourselves as a soul. Well, I really want to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So again, if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Falk. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Right, welcome back. You are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I'm your host, Dr. James Howe. Well, earlier in the show, the first half of the show, I was talking about the Disney movie Encanto. Great movie, great songs, and a great storyline. If you have never seen it, I highly recommend it. You will love it. It'll make you feel like a kid again, and the songs will get stuck in your head, and you'll just have a good time. However, don't miss the underlying message of how does a family heal from its intergenerational trauma. Because what I believe, what makes Encanto relevant to any family and the larger community, is that despite the outer pleasantries and colorful distractions, and with, you know, within many families today, there's also what I would call personality squabbles and the chaos when you get everybody together. And however, but in Encanto, not every member of the family is welcomed around the dinner table, so to speak, let alone kind of this, like this silence that permeates the movie, because we're not allowed to talk about Bruno. There's even a little song about that, you know, we can't talk about Bruno. Yeah, you watch the movie, you know what I'm singing, okay? But of course, there's always one member who wants to know the history of why things are the way they are. You know, why do we do this? Why this? Why that? And why can't we talk about Bruno? And of course, this is the same person who's trying to find her place in the family, as well as, what's my gift? Everybody else has a gift. I don't have a gift yet. What does that mean? Am I a bad person? Or, you know, or is it has yet to be revealed? And this is where the story begins to unfold, excuse me, as Bruno and Mirabel talk about their family's history and trauma and the silence that shrouds everything in that story and family. Okay? And finally, Encanto reveals to us that Mirabel's gift is actually in her strength, to be able to reveal these old wounds and dysfunctional patterns and the silence that are, you know, that are destroying this family. Because interestingly, she's the only one willing to talk about Bruno. Everybody else is like, shh, 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 we don't do this. No, we don't talk about Bruno. We can't talk about Bruno. Well, why not? We need to talk about Bruno because the silence is killing the family. because Mirabelle sees the literal and the emotional cracks in the family's foundation. You know, not just the home, but she also sees the emotional cracks in her family as they're trying to hold things together. And she just simply wants to know why. In fact, she's the only one strong enough to point them out so that the family can begin to heal. Okay. And this is, you know, just a direct correlation as to why this reason for this need to break the silence of traumatic family events is because trauma places this distorted template over our perceptions. Because trauma says to us, well, don't worry about anything else because this is all there is. And this is all there is to you. And this is as good as it's going to get. I mean, all superimposed lies and distortions that come from other wounded people who have yet to embrace themselves as a soul and who have yet to find the courage to break the silence. Because you see, once we embrace ourselves as soul, we may be astonished to understand the power of our soul to not only transcend trauma and transform our wounded energy, but also empower others to do the same. Because still, as history teaches us, you know, many have feared the resiliency and the power of the soul, and therefore have tried to silence its cry. And yet, in creating this living dialogue with those who have come before us, our ancestors, remember that our soul and our soul connection with them is not about placing blame or finding fault for wounds suffered from intergenerational trauma. It's not about going back and, you know, pointing our fingers to the great, great, great grandparents and say, well, gee, thanks for that one. But instead, it's an ongoing, it's a living dialogue intended to create an ongoing opportunity for healing and reconciliation, as well as stopping the harmful psychological, emotional, and spiritual patterns from being passed on to generations yet to be born. And so what I like to share with the kids who finally get this and like, well, why do I have to do this? It's like, well, because you're the strongest one in the family to be able to transform all the negative energy and all the pain and the suffering. Because for one reason or another, those who came before you weren't strong enough to be able to do that. And so I get them to see themselves as a transitional or a transformational generation that requires them to stand in the gap, as it were, as you know, that they offer relief and release and healing, not just for themselves, but also for all family members, regardless of whether or not, you know, in the family line there were perpetrators or victims. Well, I have friends who often set their intention to heal intergenerational trauma from the perspective of unborn generations. And this is pretty cool. Okay. Much like going back seven generations to heal souls that are stuck due to trauma, they place themselves in the role or the voice of seven generations in the future. And as stated earlier, you know, trauma has the potential to disconnect us from our understanding of who we are as a soul. And like I said, it places this distorted template over us and just says, well, that's all there is. Okay. So, but there is power in the soul because we give the soul voice. And there's power in sharing stories, stories that break the silence. And this is a phenomena that author Yuravashi Vatalia, hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, she understood this all too well, because in her book that's titled "The Other Side of Silence," she wrote about how 50 years later the people of India and Pakistan still grieve the partition of 1947. Because she noticed that when she interviewed people about how life changed for them, the men and women not only told their stories differently, but she also noticed how the women had more periods of silence in their stories. For instance, there we go. If husbands or sons were around, the women would, you know, just kind of fade into the background and allow the husbands and sons to take over the interview kind of making women lapse in sort of a silence. And the author noted that, this was not uncommon because many oral histories were written about the difficulty of speaking to and with women, or of learning to listen differently, and often listening to the hidden nuances, or, as she puts it, the half-said thing. And she came to discover that, all in all, it was the silence which was sometimes more eloquent than speech, because it was so pronounced, it was timely, and there was much more revealed. It was much more revealed in the silences that she needed to listen to. And one of the aspects that I'm discovering is that, as we transform into higher dimensions of spirituality and who we are, we indeed hear God and the universe more clearly. Because a lot of times when we suffer, one trauma after another, or just trauma in general, we want to say, okay, God, where were you? I call out to you day after day, night after night, and I hear nothing. It seems like I'm doing all the talking and I hear silence. And we automatically assume that if we don't hear from God the way we think we need to hear from God, that God doesn't care. But that's not true. Because I discovered, and thousands and thousands of others have discovered, that God's presence is clearly there in the silence. Well, I'm sure you've all heard or read the poem Footprints in the Sand. Okay, it's a poem based on the Christian belief, and it describes a person's dream in which he or she is walking on a beach with God. And as they're walking along, analogous of the person's various experiences in life, they leave two sets of footprints in the sand, and suddenly the two sets of footprints become one, especially at the lowest and most hopeless moments of that person's life. And when questioning God, believing that the Lord, well, Lord, you must have abandoned me, abandoned, the loved ones during those times, God comes through and gives the explanation. My child, look, it was during your times of trial and suffering that when you see only one set of footprints, it was then that I was carrying you. And I often think of, like, if we could just continue writing that poem, it's almost as if God says, I've carried you through your times of trial and suffering. Now you need to carry others as well until they are strong enough. Perhaps if we could just enter into a higher dimension of silence, we just might awaken to the lesson that silence doesn't automatically mean the absence of God. But yet perhaps silence is calling us to resonate with the calling to become an answer prayer for others. And as we go through life, and depending on our own experiences, we're going to start to question what used to be true for us, such as this assumption of, well, if I don't hear anything from God, that means God doesn't care. Okay, because, for example, ever since childhood, we may have a certain way in which we see ourselves, or how we see others, or what we've been taught about God in the world at large. And when we've gone through, or going through even now, an experience that shakes us up, or maybe even shatters those old assumptions, we're going to feel as though perhaps nothing makes sense anymore. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we may feel like we don't have a sense of our bearings, let alone knowing which way is up. And this could be very unnerving state or a place to find ourselves in, especially if we feel like all that we have known before is really starting to crumble and evaporate and run through our fingers like sand. And we can become so unsure of not only ourselves, but also whether or not if all that we see is all that there is. Well, perhaps that's Thomas' template again. And yet, we can weather these storms we may also discover that there's something greater than ourselves that's tugging at our soul. You know, call it a stronger nudge from God, or a more intense dimensional energy, or even a hunger that just resonates deep within by compelling us to go and search to discover the vastness of who we are. And as we go on this journey, and yes, it's a journey, we're going to discover that there are things we need to let go of, you know, things we once identified with. We need to let go of those things and transform in order to embrace a higher, more intense dimension, greater the light. In other words, rising above those negative mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual triggers that keep us from experiencing the fullness of unconditional love. And this phenomena is at the heart of a multidimensional understanding of spirituality, one that totally transforms trauma. Well, in the Oglala Lakota tradition, Frank Fool's Crow, he lived in the late 1800s and on through, I think he died in 1989, I want to say. Frank Fool's Crow taught that in order to become holy, you know, in the Lakota tradition, one through whom the Great Spirit could work in and through to heal others, person must become first like a hollow bone. And Frank Fool's Crow believed that people are not to seek transformation for their own power and honor, but instead seek transformation to be a pipeline that connects God and the people. And this process of becoming a hollow bone began and continues when people asked God to rid themselves of anything that would impede them in any way, such as doubt, or questions, or selfishness, or reluctance, or even the ego. And as a result, this psycho-spiritually transformed people, let's say, would then need to see themselves as unobstructed conduits through whom God could work to bless others. And this hollow bone analogy is a powerful symbol for emptying ourselves of everything that hinders and impedes the life of God's Spirit. Because as we are taught in biology class, and hopefully everybody out there was paying attention, as we are taught in biology class, bones provide our bodies not only with our physical frame, but also within themselves contain marrow, or this flexible tissue that's responsible for producing blood and supporting the immune system. Very important. And yet, in understanding the concept of becoming a hollow bone, we have to first acknowledge our need to, metaphorically speaking, die to ourselves. And ironically, a hollow bone is both dead in that it doesn't contain any blood or marrow, and yet at the same time, it's also alive because it's the Spirit of God flowing freely in and through us for the benefit of others. And this is not a one-time event. This act is not a one-time event, but rather it's an ongoing process of examining and letting go of ourselves in order to take hold of something better for the sake of humanity. So God is speaking all the time, but what keeps us from hearing God's voice? But again, ironically, through contemplation, we not only need to stop our mind's chatter, in other words, going in silence, but also to open our hearts regarding how we see and listen for God, especially in silence. So where do we see God in all things? In the beauty of a sunrise? As the sun glows at sunset? We focus on hearing God's voice and the cries and laughters of others? How do we feel God in the wind and the rain? Do we hear God in the sound of owls and eagles and hawks? And similarly, should we not also look for God in the tears of a child, or listen for the voice of God in every heartbreak, or find the voice of God giving us voice to speak about our losses? Well, I want to leave you with one last story tonight of finding beauty out of lives that have been shattered. And author John O'Donohue tells of a similar story of how work done with a heart that creates beauty can be found even in the midst of brokenness. And he writes that the Emperor of Japan possessed a very old and very costly vase. It was a unique masterpiece in the art of china ware, very precious indeed. And one day, somebody knocked it down by accident, and it broke into 1,000 pieces. I mean, it just shattered. And the fragments were carefully collected, and the most skilled master potters of the whole empire were commissioned to put the vase back together again. And they tried very, very hard, but they failed, and then eventually they had to pay for their failure with their heads. And the emperor put the difficult task to the second best, you know, potters in the empire, but they failed as well. And this process repeated for many, many weeks until all the master potters out there in the realm of the kingdom were beheaded, since none of them had succeeded in putting this exquisite vase back together again. And in the end, only a single artist was left, you know, an old Zen monk living with his young pupil in a cave in the mountains. And on the emperor's call, he came to the palace and he took the broken pieces with him and he carried them back to his humble workshop. And then he set to work. And after several weeks, the monk showed the results of his endeavor to his pupil. And the vase had, let's say, resurrected in its flawless beauty. And the two monks wandered back to the city and delivered the vase to the palace. The emperor was overjoyed, and the whole palace just praised the perfection of the restored masterpiece. And the old monk was richly rewarded and then gracefully dismissed. Well, one day, the young pupil was just rummaging around for something in the workshop when he unexpectedly discovered the broken scraps of the old vase. But he ran to his master and he said, "Look, look at all these pieces. Not at all did you put them back together. And yet, you managed to create a vase that is as beautiful, even more beautiful than the one that was shattered." And the old monk smiled and replied, "If you put yourself to work with a full heart of love, you will always be able to create something beautiful out of pieces." And many times we look at our brokenness or our shattered pieces from our wounds and wonder, how are these ever going to get back together? And in these moments, individuals and families who have walked the path before us tell us to come as we are, broken pieces and all. And piece by piece, our lives can be reassembled, not in a way that's familiar to us, but into a vessel that is now, ironically, stronger in the cracks. Because indeed, if we place ourselves in the hands of God, who reaches out with a full heart of love towards us, we will discover that God is able to create something beautiful out of the rubble. And quite interestingly enough, Mirabelle did just that. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you for spending this hour with me. Until we talk again in 2 weeks, everybody out there, please be safe. Everybody, please behave yourselves. And for all of us, may God hold us in the palm of God's hand. Take care, and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.